you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Tristan Verboven. What you're about to hear on the Twilight Histories is an audio version of a well-known classic, Jason and the Argonauts. If you're not familiar with the Twilight Histories, in these stories, you are the adventurer. Just like in a role-playing game, with the Twilight Histories, you are the main character, and you will travel to different dimensions, and you may discover strange and exotic cultures that never existed in our timeline. Your experience will be enhanced with music and sound effects just to stimulate your imagination and draw you into this world. When you're finished listening, go and check out our Patreon page, where you'll gain access to hours of stories that are not available to the general public, including, actually, a little bonus story for this episode. We'll give you a little extra look behind the curtain. It's like a secret bonus podcast, exclusively for our dearest patrons. Anyways, for now, sit back and get comfortable, because we're about to embark on the turquoise waters of the Mediterranean. The lapping of oars, an epic adventure awaits, a company of heroes, the Bronze Age on the Aegean, a strange world where Greek mythology meets reality, maybe even science fiction. This is Jason and the Argonauts, by me, myself, your host, Tristan Verboven. What does he see when he stares out there? You see a vast blue sea, hills on a distant shore, a narrow, craggy inlet at the bottom of cliffs. And with his strange, dead eyes, he sees clockwork. White birds at their daily hunt, migrating schools, following the tides. He sees distant skirting clouds bringing evening rains, the setting sun with northerly winds. He sees a living, breathing world. His are the aged, vacant eyes of a salt dog, locked on the sea by daylight, and resigned to the crackling fires by evening. So annoyed he is by the birds that come for his fish, that he waves a stick in the air to helplessly scare them away, and at night disappears into his shack, throwing the crude flap behind him. It has been 3 days. He has spoken little, slipping away in the morning light to gather water and fruit, and then salted fish before nightfall. And every other moment, spent, blank eyes seaward. This place, you know it well. Why, it's the Bosphorus, where Thrace meets the Levant, but long before the great Hellenist cities collided. And long before Anzac beachheads, before Ottoman armies, before the arrival of the Crusades, before the legions of Justinian. Even the great city of Constantine, at
long before it served as a Hellespont from east to west. For now, it is the sole domain of old Phineas, perched upon the rocks, no path to or from but the windy seas. But now, you're wondering, when does this adventure begin? You signed up for a visit to the Bronze Age. The one of old mythology, the one of heroes and monsters, the stories that were old even to the Greeks, the ones that the Romans retold to stir yearning in their youth, and the wisdom of their ancestors, and the lessons of fools and villains. Until you hear the voices making the slow path up the crag. Two men and a youth with the gift of dried fish. They approach Phineas with reverence. They know him well. And around the fire, the fishermen tell him of the southern seas and their healthy catch. The old man pokes the fire with a twig. He points to a cove between two peaks where the storks hover by midday and feed at dusk. All the while, the boy listens in the glow, gazing up at the men. This happens a few more times over the next days. Boatmen braving the path with fresh fish for his council. And sure enough, the Greek fisherman returns some days later, a fat haul salted and drying in the wind. Till the day comes that a mighty craft appears, a long ship, not a fishing vessel, with sails and oars, like a warship, and driven by the mighty draw of a dozen hardy men. They throw their anchor near the bay and wade up the break to shore. Three of them appear at the top of the cliff. Phineas has not met these men before. Their leader is Jason. At first, he does not stand out as such. He is not the biggest, strongest, nor even the oldest among them, but he handles himself with the air of a noble. He is accompanied by two young brothers, Zetes and Calais, hunters by their bow and steely look.
"I am told by my navigator, Typhus,"
announces Jason,
"that an old blind man named Phineas knows these parts." "I am old indeed,"
he replies,
"but my eyes see like no other."
Jason gets right to the point.
"Well, we've lost our way,"
he says flatly,
"and we seek passage north, through this strait to the seas beyond."
Phineas approaches them, checking their hands.
"Your vessel is not a fishing boat." "We're not fishermen,"
replies Jason.
"We are on a quest for a great treasure, and I've assembled a team of warriors." "You've brought no fish, then?"
Phineas interrupts rudely. Jason is caught speechless. His companions are stunned. Phineas continues, rubbing his stomach.
"My food has all but run out, and these hovering harpies, they steal my stocks. Oh, what is an old man to do?"
The brothers, having hunted birds their whole lives, step in at once, and seeing the flock lurking in the trees, Zetes quickly picks them off with a sling, while Calais catches them with his bare hands in the breeze, and within moments they return, triumphant.
We've hunted the last of them,
boasts Zetes.
You will have enough to feed for days. I should hang them to dry in such a way as others should think twice.
And as they feast on the winged beasts, the old man scratches a crude map in the dirt.
Save a few small boats,
he tells.
Scarcely a seafaring craft has braved the narrow past this point, and certainly not a ship the size of yours. She's a sturdy craft,
replies Jason.
She has a broad hull, but a shallow draft. Then she stands a chance,
says Phineas.
If you follow my counsel.
Jason listens carefully.
Black storks shall fly the narrow strait.
The old man drags his twig across the map.
They follow a migrating school. These fish seek deep waters to avoid them, waters enough for your keel. Follow them, and you will reach the other side. How can I thank you?
Asks Jason, sharing a glance with his companions.
You have spared me the torment of these harpies and left them for my stock.
The old man points to you now.
Take this one with you on your journey. I'm sure you can find some use.
The men who had taken little notice of you until this point check you up and down.
Can you pull an oar?
You nod, yes.
You're already more useful than most of the men aboard, then.
His companions snicker. The Argo is an impressive craft, by any standard, but not built for comfort. The hull is long, curving up narrow at the prow, and the aft steadied by two rudders. And the first thing you notice, nails, belt buckles, tools, weapons, everything is made with a reddish tint bronze. And they dress simply, tunics and wraps protected from the sun, cool from the breeze. Introducing you to the crew, Jason fills them in. Come morning, they will wait for the flock of migrant storks, and by tomorrow they should be on the high seas again, sailing uncharted waters. Among them there's Peleus, a prince and friend of Jason, supposedly a friend of the goddess Hera as well. And Acastus, an old friend of Jason from his kingdom. Then there's Idas of Messan, evidently also some kind of prince, though the regal decorum must be lost at sea. And the Boread brothers, who we have already met. People say they can fly, skillful hunters nonetheless. Castor and Pollux, also brothers, also hunters. Ancaeus and Tippus, our skilled navigators, who can guide the ship by sun and stars. And last but not least, equally skilled oarsmen, Erginus and Euphemus, who are said to have been the sons of Poseidon himself. The entire crew groans at this new plan, as it contains no clear possibility for heroics, plunder, or women, and instead requires an endless day of dangerous and annoying navigation. So the men settle into their modest berths and, pruning their flowing beards with herbs and oils, and habitually sharpening their copper weapons, polishing them to a shine, Orpheus is the storyteller among them. His favorite tale, the great boar hunt. Many of the crew were there for it, and they sing along poorly as the gentle plucks of his harp resonate over the waters. By the sound of it, you've already missed most of the adventure. In fact, some of the most celebrated crew members are no longer here. Heracles and Hylas, the stars of the show, got lost early. Carefully tuning his strings, Orpheus begins the tale. It was the early days of the voyage, and at first setting sail, in fact, before even seeing a day of peril, they touched in at Lemnos, hoping to restock for the journey. The men could not help but notice that only women lived on this island. It was not clear why or how, but the women had suffered a pest that made their flesh foul. And as it worsened, husbands and sons, unable to bear the stench, fled to find new wives. None dared return. But luckily, by the time the Argo arrived, the stench had passed, and though they had not been at sea for long, they were still happy to see so many women. And the women were happy to oblige, and they left these maidens' sons behind, no doubt. But Jason wasn't having it. Had it not been for his important mission to find the Golden Fleece, they would probably still be there today. Besides, greater adventures awaited across the sea at far reaches, and it was not long before the men saw real adventure. A few days hence, a narrow inlet broadened again to open sea, and touching in at Arctonesus, Jason was welcomed by a local king and invited for a merry feast. Heracles, still grumbling that he had not spent enough time on the island of women, was in no mood for this mirth and stayed behind to watch the ship. With the crew away, some giants with six arms tried to scuttle the boat. He took them alone, slaying each one and throwing their bodies to the sea.
Nobody actually saw these creatures themselves,
interjects Pollux.
But it makes for a great story.
The men have a laugh.
Oh, who would doubt such a story from the likes of Heracles,
continues Orpheus. But it was not long before another great challenge was upon them. A few days later, at a quiet cove near Mysia, Hylas waded ashore alone to find a river to fill his skin.
Well, wait a second.
You put up your hand to stop the story.
Who's Hylas?
The men all catch each other's eyes.
He was Heracles' servant. Student? No, just friend,
says Orpheus.
Let's just say he was very fond of him. And when he did not return in haste, Heracles went ashore to find him.
Still none of the men say a word.
Jason was impatient to leave,
recalls Orpheus.
As were Castor and Pollux, and he did not want to lose more time. You know, greater foe awaited. Wait, so what became of the great Heracles then,
you ask?
And his Hylas? Neither returned to us,
he replies, chuckling.
Even strong and mighty men have their weaknesses. Besides, what could we rescue Heracles from that he could not rescue himself from?
This, of course, may not have been such a good idea, for sure enough, they could have used his strength a few days later when they touched in again, this time at Bithynia. their king, Amicus, at first welcomed the crew warmly, but at dinner, the king changed his tone. On the topic of boxing, he challenged any one of the crew to a fight, and that the loser of the match shall pay with his life.
"We all immediately regretted having abandoned Heracles just days before,"
laughs Pollux.
"I felt I was somewhat to blame, so I offered to challenge the king myself."
"You certainly did,"
laughs Orpheus. Pollux stands awkwardly weighing the sway of the ship.
"I stood before him, chest out and chin up, and I told him that I would defend the honor of the crew."
Pollux stands proudly, hands on his hips.
"And as soon as he accepted the challenge, I sucker punched him right in the throat."
"It did not go well after that,"
continues Orpheus.
"We kind of had to leave that place in a hurry."
So far, the stories are not that impressive. An island full of women, a monster attack that may or may not have happened, and two crew members wandering off never coming back, and a cheap shot to get out of a real fight. Looks like you haven't actually missed all that much. And so far, the epic of Jason and the Argonauts has been mostly a frat boy road trip. But in terms of actual historical significance, what happens next is probably a first. During the Bronze Age, few had actually ever sailed a seafaring vessel through the Bosphorus Strait to the Black Sea. There's a reason no one had done it before. The Argo certainly had no business going through here. Jason directing off the stern and steadying the rudder. Soon enough, the Argo creaks over shoals and squeaks perilously through shallows, pulling through to the open seas again. And so, training the strange coast eastward to Colchis to find the golden fleece kept by King Aetius, join in with the merry band of heroes on a valiant quest to throne a worthy king, yearning for the far reaches of the known world, the first Greek seaman ever to sail it. Heroes. No. Legends. So far, though, been a bit of a bro fest. These southern shores and eastern currents are what is now known as the Black Sea. The coast is known as Turkey, and it runs due east with little in the way of rough seas. And it's not like there's nobody here. The coast is littered with villages, their tiny fishing boats giving a wide berth to our strange ship, and our oars gliding in unison along the dark waters. And all that way, Jason has time to think. Time to get serious about this enterprise. His goal is to bring back one great treasure, the Golden Fleece. Not just because it's gold, and not just because it holds the secret of pulling gold from a flowing river. It's that it will give him his rightful throne. But this will take more than a raiding band of pirates. Jason must prove his mettle as a statesman. So, he's decided his approach will be to walk in the front door, and ask for it. Simple as that. And, you know, see what happens. Till soon enough, Ancaeus calls out from the lookout of a great city with a sprawling harbor. Jason readies himself, handsome in his noble finery. And the Argo, gleaming in the noonday sun, careens into the port. A pilot guides the ship to a long pier, and he steps ashore to the royal welcome of King Aetius and his strangely attired entourage. The town is bigger than the ones we've seen until now, and by the looming palace upon the hill, obviously the capital of a kingdom. But by the look of the eyes of the welcoming party, they're not accustomed to strange visitors, and certainly not Greek warships. The king receives Jason, accepting his gifts and gracious bows. Presents his family, his daughter Chalciope, and of course, the young and dazzling Medea. And of course, his son Absyrtus, who looks on with suspicion. Medea, though, now there's a looker. You can tell right away from the moment their eyes meet that this is definitely on. Jason and Medea, that is. It's not just the lecherous look of a man who's been at sea, nor the curious flirt of a girl meeting a charming prince. Oh no, this is much deeper. It's so hot that Absyrtus has to physically step between them. They are ushered to the palace with great ceremony, but the two of them only have eyes for each other. This carries on for some time, right through to the evening's feast, a great hall with wooden carvings and spoils of the hunt. King Aetius sits with Absyrtus and a half a dozen of his men. Jason sits next to Acastus, and with his other Argonauts, including yourself, and the women sit nearby at another table. The plates of food are loaded onto the table in front of you. It's quite a spread. Roasted boar, many types of game and fish, followed by strange fruits and fragrant nectars. And our fearless leader, settling into the hospitality, finally gets around to his important business. Emboldened by a quick glance at the beautiful princess, he stands up.
King Aetius, it is an honor to be your guest and to be the first ambassador of the people of Hellas.
He raises his cup.
I've promised my people, as a show of good faith, that I would return to them a long-lost treasure. And so I have come to ask you for the Golden Fleece.
The room falls silent. The king exchanges a glance with his son, and then a look is thrown at Medea.
Jason of Iolcus, son of Aeson, I should not want to deny such a request, as our people can do well to be in alliance with the people of Hellas. But the fleece must only go to the one who is worthy.
He looks Jason up and down.
Are you worthy?
The room rumbles in a low gasp, and without missing a beat, Jason replies,
I will prove it.
The Argonauts look on proudly. Amused, the king declares Jason to perform 3 extraordinary tasks. Absyrtus cannot hide his delight as he describes each ordeal to the court and the perils attributed to them. The first task seems easy enough. The king tells him to plow the field behind the palace using his oxen. Acastus, who knows Jason well from his time in exile, leans over and whispers in your ear,
That should be easy. Little does the king know that Jason was not raised a delicate, pampered prince, and that he can handle many beasts of burden.
The king then tells him that once this field is plowed, to sow the teeth of a dragon into the fresh soil. Acastus again leans over.
I think this king's trying to mock him.
And finally, the king warns Jason that if he still lives through that, he must face the mighty dragon, who never sleeps and who protects the fleece with his life.
Dragon indeed,
whispers Acastus.
Who's ever heard of such a thing?
Jason bows to the king to accept his challenge, and then returns to his meal. Once we are fed to our fill, we are all given the finest accommodations and told to rest, for the great trial shall begin by morning. Each of us is taken to our own room within the palace, comfortable and clean, a nice change from the hold of a warship at sea. That night, you lay in bed and you think to yourself, if Jason is perhaps too brazen, certainly the king has no intention of giving up his treasure. A faint sound comes from the corridor, and a light outside Jason's door, a shrouded figure, a woman. Staying in the shadows, you make your way quietly towards the light. Your ear to the door, in a low voice.
The Golden Fleece is the most heavily guarded treasure in the kingdom. My father and my brother do not wish to test you. They wish to kill you.
It is Medea.
Tomorrow, the accent will be no regular accent. Their code will burn you at the touch. Their hide soaked in poison. Take this vial. The oil will protect your skin.
But why are you helping me?
Asks Jason. Medea puts her fingers to her lips.
My father speaks in riddle. The dragon's teeth are a trap. If you saw them, you will be ambushed by my father's assassins dressed in ghastly bones. You must alert your men to stop them as they emerge from the surrounding bushes. Or they will overwhelm you in battle.
You would betray your father like that?
Asks Jason.
And the dragon. Be warned, the beast is real and powerful. Leave that creature to me. Prepare your men to launch immediately once the fleece is yours. There will be no time to spare.
How can I repay you?
Pleads Jason. Medea whispers.
You will take me with you.
And so the day begins bright and early. Jason is summoned to a field before the king, who sits aloft, surrounded by attendants. And his loyal Absyrtus stands below him, resting his hand on the hilt of a beautiful weapon. Tethered before them, two mighty beasts, and a yoke carved from a single tree trunk. The oxen grunt impatiently. You join Orpheus and Tiphys, who stand by to witness the trial. Jason skillfully brings the beasts around, fastening the beam behind their horns, and comforting them gently as he fastens the straps. He digs the bronze blade into the earth, turning the rich soil to bear the hot sun. The king does not betray his seething rage, and Absyrtus, however, lets it be known. Once the length of the field has been plowed, the prince calls to cease. "That's enough!" he announces. And he takes Jason's hand, rubbing the film of his darkened skin, and in it places a handful of broken teeth.
"Plant these and see what grows from it,"
he scowls. Jason walks to the end of the field, dropping the teeth one by one. And at the end of the cut, he reaches down and plants the last one, himself, lifting a stone as he rises. The prince's smirk fades as Jason tosses the stone into the bushes, and hearing a voice to wince in pain. But one by one, the bodies of the assassins fall out of the bushes, headless, behind each one. A mighty Argonaut, shiny bloodied sword in hand. And the king, now too betraying his anger, motions to his son to take care of this situation. But Jason is gone, quickly sprinting the path up to the mountain where the dragon guards the fleece. We too follow the scene. The prince, now his weapon brandished, climbs some paces behind, keeping his eyes firmly on our leader. But at the threshold of the dragon's domain, Jason, fearless, weaponless, steps over the crest. And expecting to hear the snarling growls of a mighty beast, we instead hear the snoring of a giant creature, lost in a pleasant dream. Enraged, Absyrtus raises his sword in anger, finding only a blade thrust through his gut. Behind his bleeding corpse, wielding a spear in both hands, in deep satisfaction, is the lovely Medea, her eyes locked on Jason, paying no mind to her brother's lifeless body as its murdered corpse falls face first into the dust. So much for Jason the Statesman. Yet another king's hospitality turned ugly, and yet another sticky situation solved by a sucker punch. The Argonauts have done it again, bumbled their way out of another situation with cunning and nerve. Only this time, with quite a bit of help from a beautiful princess. Needless to say, the two of them spend the next days cozied up in the semi-privacy of the Argo's forecastle, lounging out on the fleece, no doubt. Not really sure what to do next, actually. Sailing west, take the golden fleece to the king, I guess, and claim the throne. How does the epic tale of Jason and the Argonauts end anyways? So many different versions of the story. None of this stuff was in it. The whole thing is a bit anticlimactic. Also, not entirely comfortable bringing this mysterious woman aboard. Not just a flagrant breach of bro code, but like, who is she even? Yes, very beautiful, and yes, totally helped us out back there,
but more kind of like a psycho way. So pretty soon the boys are going to start getting fed up of doing all the rowing while Jason enjoys the spoils. After a few days of this, our lovebirds finally appear on deck. Jason asks Tiffus for the bearings.
"We weren't sure you'd come out alive," jokes Orpheus. "Supplies are low, the men are tired, and we're out of water,"
says Tiffus.
"And I have no idea where we are, except that we're going back the way we came."
"These lands are still the domain of my father,"
interjects Medea.
"We will not be safe should they get word of what has happened."
Medea has already ditched her royal garb, opting for something a little more practical, an elegant tunic held together by a belt with layers of creases. The crew turns to Jason, who is mulling it over.
"I know these waters well. There is an island, a day's sea west from here, say warring, a spring to replenish our guards, and some game."
She looks to Jason.
"Onward then," he announces. "Let's make haste for this island."
The island is not much to look at. Tiny, really. A kind of rugged boulder cliffside. No settlement, but a cove for mooring. A strange sight, indeed, emerges. A bronze statue glistens in the morning light. Twice the size of a man perched atop the highest point. What curious shrine sits upon this tiny island? Which of the gods is worshipped here? Jason pilots the craft into the moorings, and some of the men go waist deep to secure the lines. But wait, what is this? Did I just see that statue move? The creature buckles suddenly. My God, it's a siege engine! A projectile smashes through the main mast, ricocheting off the bow. The crew sits motionless and stunned. And then, another volley. Jason orders the ship about, and the rest of the men abandon their oars to find their weapons. But the projectile breaks through the Argo's hull. Seeing no hope aboard, as she takes on water and dive into the blue, braving the tide, cursing the urchins with the other men, drenched and disoriented. They charge up the hill at the creature. Swinging his copper gauntlets, the statue bears down upon them, glancing them off the cliff, and Castor manages to cling to his shiny breastplate, pounding with his pommel, while Pollux tries to choke him from behind. And in an instant, the bronze figure illuminates in a terrible glow, sending out rays of heat in every direction. Bodies are scorched beyond recognition. Others dashed off the rocks into the sea. The last of the men attempt a daring charge, each finding a scorching blow. Their charred remains launched over the cliff. Finally, there's only you and Jason. He looks back a moment at the last of his ship as it slips under the whitecaps. And in a rage, pushes one last hopeless assault on the giant, and his head is smashed to pieces by a mighty blow.
Senath Talos,
cries a voice from behind you. It's Medea. Her clothes drenched to the waist, wrapped in the golden fleece.
Let this one live, so he can tell the tale.
The creature stops in its tracks, standing once again at attention, and Medea stands before it, hands on her waist. Kneeling down, she places her hands on his foot. Then, pulling a plug from his ankle, she lets gush a sparkling fluid. And as the heavenly elixir pools to the earth, the statue teeters to one side and collapses. She announces proudly.
From the pyramids of Egypt, sad to see it go to waste. But my adventure here is over.
It's a strange substance. It's milky and glowing. And soon after it's exposed to the sun, it hardens to stone. And as you approach, Medea climbs the pile of bronze armor to reveal its face. The breastplate is marked with hieroglyphs, and the pinnacle bearing a cartouche with the unmistakable figure of the pharaoh god, Seth. She tenderly touches his cheeks in heavenly peace.
Oh, my dear Talos,
she smiles.
You have served me so well. Did I not promise you eternal life? Did I not promise you a great battle?
She flips up the bronze plate. Below it, a sight you wish you had never seen. It's not a body at all, but a sucking orifice, pulsating like a million tiny insects, each floating in the swill, a black paste of a creature, inextricable from its metallic prison. She then removes more of the breastplate, bones swimming in a pulsating ooze, organs flailing and sputtering as the fleshy mass wastes away.
But why?
You ask.
Why what?
Snaps Medea.
Why did I spare you?
The creature sputters its last convulsions.
I've got what I wanted.
She looks at you.
Another treasure to add to my collection. This one took a while, though. Had to keep old Talos here locked away for centuries. You have any idea how hard is it to hold this thing all the way from Egypt? And to get my hands back her? You have no idea.
But wait a minute, you say. Are you...
The adventure is over.
She chuckles.
It's been fun, though.
How did you...
Come on now. A magician never reveals the trick.
You look back at the scene. The bodies of your comrades, bludgeoned and strewn, face down bobbing in the rocks. The mighty Argonauts, having died in battle, and the mast of the mighty Argo, our home, our warship, floating around the cove in bits, in a sad heap of bronze armor, its leaking essence coagulating slowly in the sun, its occupant already blackened and sunken. As for Medea, well, she's already gone, and in a moment you will be too, saying goodbye to this strange shaggy dog story. But you take one last look out at the sea, and you close your eyes, It's over.
That was Jason and the Argonauts by myself, Tristan Verboven. If you enjoyed this episode, there is actually a bonus story which is available only to our dearest patrons. You could become one of them. Here's a little sneak preview. You are seated in a square windowless room. Spartan simplicity, both soothing and intimidating. A single door. Table with two chairs across from you. A small shelf with binders. Blank walls. Stucco ceiling panels. And humming.
So,
the man in the lab coat flaps open a folder.
The Bronze Age. In Egypt.
He's older than the other man. Silver hair slicked back. Pale skin on black glasses.
I'm Dr. Gottlieb, and this is Larry Devlin.
We're with National Security, says Devlin.
He's got a harsh grin. Black pants and white shirt with horn-rimmed glasses. Definitely not a scientist. Company man. He lights a cigarette, returning the pack to the table in a plume of smoke. He looks at you for a moment.
The Cult of Seth.
Tilts his head to the side.
Any particular reason?
He's the god of chaos, storms, and disorder, you reply. What more is there to say? Devlin leans forward on his chair.
Well, that's why we've organized this briefing. Preliminary protocol.
The doctor hands him the folder, marked Operation White Coat.
The Bronze Age was a pretty messed up time, especially the Nile Delta. And especially this particular time, and especially this particular cult. What we know makes us want to know what we don't know.
The doctor turns on a slide projector. A slender Egyptian figure with a black, disfigured head comes up on the walls of an ancient temple.
This is the ancient god Seth, as you know, from the first dynasty in Egypt.
This is what we know,
interjects Devlin. Dr. Gottlieb looks down at his notes.
He was a prince as well as a king for some time, and, as you say, the god of chaos, storms, and violence. The story of how it got that way is very strange. Popular religious leader, usually depicted with the head of an unidentified creature.
The head worries us. We have reason to believe it's not just mythology,
says Devlin, putting out his cigarette.
Considering the temperature at the time, the humidity levels in that ecosystem, we suspect an apicomplex and obligate parasite manifesting a deformative stroma. It's an early phylogenic form of what we now call filamentous infection.
Devlin lights another cigarette.
Let's just say he's not wearing a mask.
The doctor looks at the clipboard again.
This tularemia heterotrophic, highly contagious, spread through a spore-secreting ascus, causes cells to produce unregulated proteins and ultimately disrupts impulses to the executive function in order to facilitate further dissemination.
Devlin chuckles to himself.
It's a super-spreader cult. Seth is getting high off his own supply, spreading God's love through a mind-control drug that he ritually sprays on his followers. It's the stuff of nightmares.
Mr. Devlin is correct,
confirms the doctor.
The effects include some facial deformity and euphoria, enhanced physical strength, and appetite. Chaos.
Yeah, that was just a short 2-minute sample of this bonus for today's show. If you want to hear the whole thing, not to mention an entire library of time travel adventures going back 12 years, go ahead and become a supporting member of the Twilight Histories on Patreon. Just by running a search on Patreon for Twilight Histories, or go to the website at twilighthistories.com where you can follow the link to Patreon. I'm Tristan Verboven. Thanks for listening to The Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.